Right, are we all here? But anyway, we'll start. So welcome to the final instalment of today's conference, The Problematics of Conserving, this panel is called. First speaker is Angela Cassidy, who's a lecturer at Exeter specialising in science and technology studies. And Angela's paper is called They Can Easily Protect Themselves, you see. Conflicting Logics of Care in a UK Badger Culling Event.
Thank you. Okay, so just to, before I kind of really get stuck into this, a couple of sort of explanatory comments. So I am working on a history of bovine TB in the UK since the late 1960s. So that's kind of 45, 50 years of history. And looking at the full history of the controversy over badger culling, which has actually been going since 1971. And a key theme there is the way that actually the same arguments keep coming back and recirculating. But today's paper is focused specifically on one of my other research questions, which is about why does this issue cause quite so much trouble in this country at this particular time? And within that, the question of what does it mean to care about badgers and TB? Just to explain, this is a lady called Eunice Overend, who actually very recently died, who was one of three or four very key activists campaigning against culling through the 1970s and 1980s. And this quote is from an oral history interview with her, and if I'm lucky, I'll be able to get to the other end of the talk and put this into context. So, just to give you, this is my lovely potted history, because there's a lot to pot, of the situation with bovine TB. So bovine TB is caused by a separate bacteria to human TB, but bovine TB is actually tuberculosis that can infect all mammals, so it's not species specific, unlike all the other tuberculoses. Anyway, so it means that it's potentially a zoonotic disease. And so, since the middle of the last century, it's been subject to a number of kind of state-led controls to try and keep it out of the food chain and also to regulate the disease, but more specifically in cattle. So by the late 1960s, which is about where my story starts, my bigger story, the eradication of TB in cattle in Britain was really widely expected. So this was a little piece that was in the Times. Everyone was kind of like, yeah, we've sorted this, it's going to be fine. However, it didn't go away. And what actually happened is the disease went right down, but persisted in a few areas. And so MAF, which is the Ministry of Agriculture, was very worried about this. And while they were worrying in the background, connection was made and finding bovine TB in wild badgers. I'll come on to, for those of you who are not from the UK, what on earth a badger is in a minute. So we had, between 1971 and 1975, a remarkably speedy progress through to several legislative changes and a full-scale culling policy by 1975. That's another story. We then had widespread protests over the culling policy then, which used gas. I'll come back to that. The first of, I think now, there's been about 12 scientific reviews of this issue in 1980. And then we, from the 80s onwards, we went into this strange cycle of public controversy, further scientific research, expert review, more controversy, more research, and it's still going. So the latest iteration of that has been through the 1990s and 2000s, so a very, very, very large experimental field trial trying to figure out whether culling actually helps control TB in cattle. It had a very unexpected finding, which is that under some circumstances, culling badgers can actually potentially make it worse than cattle. So completely the other way around to what everyone expected. This science, in the way of science, has then become interpreted in multiple ways by multiple political actors ever since. And since 2010, we've seen a very rapidly escalating public controversy around this. So, this is my slide, which originally I put together for talking when I wasn't in the UK, because otherwise I realised that my research makes no sense. But actually, I think to have it here when I'm speaking in the UK is also important to highlight how local and specific this case is in terms of how the controversy relates to agriculture and ideas about agriculture, the symbolism of agriculture. So this is from the Olympic opening ceremony a few years ago, which actually opened with our agrarian past. Cattle farming, as you can see, has a very particular role within this. And then we also have specific histories around conservation and welfare to do with the loss of most of our large predators, the Industrial Revolution, ideas about romanticism, and also suffrage for people and animals coming through in the 19th century at the same time. Briefly, animals have been political in Britain for a very long time, and in ways that globally are actually quite unusual. Within this, this is a badger, and so it's a nocturnal animal, it burrows, it's omnivorous, which means that it will eat pretty much anything it can get its nose on. It's also quite big, quite tough, it smells terrible. If you live nearby, it's not an easy animal to live with. And it has also figured from time to time within some of these discourses around romanticism, around animal protection, and through the 20th century being rehabilitated into, from a vermin animal into charismatic wildlife. Again, that's another paper. So what I'm doing here, and you'll have to bear with me because I'm going to be dotting about all over the place, I'm trying to think about what it means to care about this issue and right the way across the board. So to explain what I'm doing in this work, I'm fundamentally drawing on traditions of controversy studies. So I'm studying this as a public controversy. This means that while I'm doing the research, I need to try and not be positioned within that research. It doesn't mean I don't have a position, but it means in terms of my methodology, I'm trying to understand all sides rather than necessarily thinking about the truth of it. And it also means in terms of the politics and the ethics, I need to understand those different views from multiple sides. Also, as part of that, to be reflexive about this, I'm not a country person. I grew up in London, I always live in cities, I quite like living in cities. But I did train in zoology. I think some of the ways that people think about animals is really quite odd, particularly in terms of the fact that eating or not eating them, whether we live near them or not near them, whether we're thinking about the animal or the representation of the animal. So that's me. That's kind of broadly where I'm coming from. And it means that obviously I have some, particularly the zoology training means that I find it easier to think with some of these groups than others. What I'm doing in this paper is I'm trying to draw on some recent research, mostly in STS, but some of it has been applied to animals, thinking about the idea of logics of care. So what does it mean to affect people's practice when they are caring about a particular thing? And also comparing across care and health between humans and animals. I'm not going to go through all of these papers, but these are some of the pieces of research that do this in various different ways. My start point in terms of the work itself is the sick suffering badger. Something that's very noticeable in the public controversy, media coverage, is online discourse, is that the place where the sick badger, so the badger with TB, becomes visible, is in the pro-cull side. Anti-cull activists really don't like to talk about sick badgers, which seems a bit weird. So why is that? Also, looking through the history of this debate, not necessarily the centre of the public debate, but what gets decided in terms of practical policy often turns on the question of humaneness. Is the way we're having to kill these animals humane or not? And that can determine what happens to policy. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is try and kind of run through some of the what I think are the logics of care in the different groups involved here. and hopefully I will get to the other end and then I'll be able to talk a little bit about what I think that means for the controversy. So, to start with, so Anne-Marie Moll's original work was actually about patient healthcare, human healthcare, and she was talking about the logic of care, so that's fairly obvious, that runs through healthcare, and how that then counteracts within health systems about the logic of choice, so individual choice and consumer choice, and how that's not necessarily the best thing for people. But more what I'm interested in is what that can also tell us when you contrast it with veterinary medicine. So within human healthcare, there's an issue of balancing suffering, but ultimately the priority is to preserve life. So within the modern version of the Hippocratic Oath, there's stuff there about euthanasia, must not play God. It means that when infectious disease is being managed, the priority is on prevention, on treatment, on vaccination. In the UK context, thinking about the role of human medicine with the state, it means the state support obviously for public health, for treatment, and extensively for biomedical research, and that shapes the relationship between research and practice in human medicine. In veterinary medicine, things are rather different. So the preservation of life, whether it's most important to keep the animal alive, is primarily dependent on the role of the animal. Is the animal a pet? Is the animal a working animal? Is the animal food? And also on the decisions of the owner. Minimising suffering tends to take priority over preserving life. And so the act of euthanasia as care is something that several people have written about. In terms of managing infectious disease, particularly amongst livestock, which is what I'm particularly interested in, there's kind of almost a standard way of doing this, which involves protecting a space, culling infected animals, clearing the infection, and keeping the infection out. Vaccination does happen, but it does tend to be much more towards pets. It's not the first thing that's thought about. The state is only really involved in disease surveillance, and then obviously mostly oriented towards how that affects economic output or human public health. In terms of the relationship between the medical practitioner and the patient for a vet is actually the owner of the animal. And also, because of this much less state involvement, it means that the patient is also the client. And so that means that logic of choice is much, much more powerful. In terms of veterinary care in bovine TB, as I've already mentioned, through the late 1960s, there was this persistent worry about why TB wasn't going away. When badgers were found with TB, the very initial reaction was to go out and try and look and finding them. And then, of course, the immediate response was very much this standard infection control. Okay. So the disease is there in wildlife, we must get rid of the disease to protect what we're trying to protect, which is cattle. There's a very particular nature of knowledge building that was going on, particularly in the 1970s. Obviously, veterinary epidemiology has moved along a lot since then. But it meant that a lot of it was about mapping. So this is a map actually drawn by the vet who originally made this connection of Gloucestershire, where he's mapping the cases in badgers, the outbreaks in cattle. There's a bit that's marked out here, because originally there was just one case, and then when they started looking, they found loads and loads and loads, and that's why this map is kind of scribbled over and changed, and so their understanding of what's actually going on is changing. They're finding really sick animals. The ways they're investigating is also through pathology and individual case investigation. And that mapping is being done in a very specific and not a particularly easy environment. So this is mostly being done by people who live here, which is the Gloucestershire escarpment. Believe me, I've driven up and down that thing. It's not an easy place, and so imagine trying to find an animal that you know nothing about, that is nocturnal, that you know is sick, in that. It's a very, very field-based mode of investigation. Okay, farmers. So, mostly I'm drawing here extensively on other people's work around farming and care. So particularly the contradictions, the difficulties of livestock farming, that you're raising animals, but you're raising them for food. So that means they have to be killed. A number of different cases looking at the kind of emotional management that farmers have to do in order to do this work. Whether it's the kind of farming, this lovely idealised idea here, or whether it's this kind of farming, in any case, there has to be emotional management. This is not an easy thing to do. Then there's a lot of work, particularly around foot and mouth disease, looking at what happens when animals have to be killed at another time, when the death is happening in the wrong place, and that's when it becomes even harder because all that emotional management breaks down. Thinking about farming as care, farmers talking about themselves as stewardship. And this is a much broader sense of care, so it's not just care for the animals, it's also care for the land, for the landscape of the farm, and the farm's space in particular. One of the things about this form of care is that it very much necessitates control over that space and over its occupants. And this means that biosecurity can be a really highly ambiguous concept. In some contexts, for some farmers, it really fits with this idea of control. In other contexts, it really, really doesn't, and it disrupts the idea of their work being care for the land. So, in the case of bovine TB, as I mentioned, what we've got is a situation where the disease control is mostly effective, so we're not seeing sick animals. So we get a displacement of the health risks into economic risks for the government and also for the farmers themselves. There's a very recent shift where governments are trying to take the responsibility and cost of things like disease control from the state and push it out onto industry. And that's kind of one of the political agendas that's going on in the background of this. What we do know is that there's definitely evidence that farmers are experiencing this really significant financial and emotional stress when they're suffering extensive TB breakdowns. Animals and TB on the farm. So I'll come on to that second thing in a minute. But firstly, I had to really hunt to find a picture of a sick cow. But it also means because farmers can't do anything about TB, and I'm 5 minutes already, so I'm going to have to start speeding up like crazy, it means they take action with badgers. And this quote, which I don't have time to go with, is from someone who's actually involved in the shooting trials right now. He's talking about this extensively as an act of care, which I think is fascinating. Okay, so badger protection people. As you may or may not know, there's a very long history of conflict between humans and badgers in the UK. The campaigns for specific protection were actually happening before the connection with TB. So badgers have already become a political animal by the time the TB connection comes in. Very odd and interesting alliance between rescue people, lab sports activists, naturalists, conservationists, media, the Women's Institute, and various lords, leading to several attempts at legislation. But it was only when the TB comes through that we actually get specific protections for badgers, and that's partly because government needed to license culling action as well. We had protests over gassing policies during the 70s, and so we get a number of different strategies of how to protect badgers. So you have kind of a very policy science-oriented way of thinking about it. You have moving more towards professional lobbying, activism, and then you have action that individuals are taking. And one of the things that I think is quite striking about a lot of this action is if you think about this is an animal that's notorious for being a pain in the arse, for having a lot of agency. It's all a bit cute and fluffy. It seems to me like often that even within the kind of work that's being done to protect the animals, it's not really thinking about the animal's experience of that action. There's also increasingly, as time goes on, more and more an emphasis on the dead badger as opposed to the suffering badger. The suffering badger as a consequence of human action is quite visible, but we get more and more concern about badgers being killed. Okay, now, frankly, this needs three slides. I don't have time. But what we do have is this very squishy interface between natural history, conservation, and field science, particularly around this issue. We have people shifting from one domain to the other. And they have very particular logics of care that are also about knowing stuff. So care for the environment and the land, as well as particular species. The welfare of the environment is balanced with the welfare of the individual animal, with the life of the animal. The idea that gaining valid knowledge is a greater good, so this idea of the sacrifice in science, which has obviously already been written about. And what happens is across these different areas, these things are being balanced in slightly different ways, and that's also changing over time. There's a very important thread of vernacular, kind of everyday experiential knowledge about badgers. So at the time when the connection was first made, the only people who knew anything about badgers were amateur naturalists. The ministry had no idea what these creatures were. Scientists had no idea either. And what I've also seen is a recurring thing where it means that people who are involved with badgers in this way know that things like badgers moving around and spreading disease is a problem, that gassing isn't working. They know this before anyone officially knows it. Conservationists themselves, the different conservation groups, sometimes they're involved, sometimes they're not. The idea of whether an animal is threatened. So badgers are not rare. So there's this whole debate about whether conservation should be involved at all. And I think there's some interesting finagling going on around this word threatened. If you think about it, we talk about endangered species, we talk about animals under threat, we talk about that when we're actually talking about rarity, but it allows us to then slide into whether the animal is physically under threat, whether we're caring for it. Okay, so Eunice. So she was a badger protection activist, but also a naturalist. And she was one of the people who very much anticipated the idea that culling might be a problem for disease control. But specifically in the context of this interview, it's very interesting, because she doesn't like the idea of badger protection. And that's partly because she's out there working with the animals all the time, and she knows that they're not really particularly passive animals. She knows that they're quite fierce, they're quite powerful. And that's the joke that she's kind of making here. Last slide. So, I mean, what does all this mean? Fundamentally, I think part of what's driving the intensity of this controversy is that you have these different logics of care. And some of them, as you've seen, are actually completely mutually exclusive. And I think it does mean that that most of the people intensely involved with this problem on one side or another really passionately care about it. But what they particularly care for or care about or how they're doing the caring is very, very different. We also see that the logics of care change over time. So we move where a very good example of this is, for example, the Badger Trust, who, when the major piece of science was first conducted on culling, actually tried to get it stopped through legal action because it involved killing badgers. Whereas now, they're hugely supportive of that self-same piece of science because it is supporting their case. The British Veterinary Association policy in the last few years has started shifting, and this is because animal welfare has become much more of a prioritisation within that profession as opposed to farming veterinary interests. Do politicians care? Is an interesting question in this. Those that are deeply involved with this case really care. Mostly, they care about much other things, and they really don't care about TB at all, unless they have to. Also, there's been a lot of times where TB has ended up being submerged by other much more pressing concerns. BSC and MATF are both examples of that. We see policy change on TV often comes with a regime change, so Labour to Tories and back again. Also Blair to Brown, by the way. Sometimes politicians care a lot, and sometimes they care almost too much, and I think Owen Paterson, who's a recent agriculture minister, was very invested in this case, is a very good example of that, where his caring about this was so powerful that it actually made the issue more difficult for government. Finally, thinking about this kind of what's happened over this 40-year period, I don't know for sure, but I do get a sense that these logics of care are becoming more mutually exclusive over time. And I don't entirely understand why. What we are seeing is that it's getting more and more bound up with mainstream political oppositions, and those in and of themselves are becoming more polarised and more oppositional. I also see the TV issue becoming increasingly entangled within adjacent politics, so not just animal politics, but also politics around agriculture, the environment, and now, yeah, it has to be said, Brexit. And at that slightly depressing point, I'm going to stop. But I hope you found that interesting and not too confusing. And,